and welcome to We Are History with me, John O'Farrell.
And me, Angela Barnes.
Thank you for tuning in once again. Remember, if you want to get your episodes a week early, you can join our Patreon supporters
club. I'm looking forward to this bit to see if John remembers the website.
It's www.podmasters.com.
No!
Oh, you tell it, Angela.
Patreon.com/We Are History.
That's what I said, wasn't it? Like that. Well, join that. You get extra episodes. You get content that you wouldn't otherwise get if you were just listening on the Apple podcast. Plus, you get the episodes a week early, ad-free, and you get £1,000 cash in an envelope.
No, Josh, no, John. I keep telling you, that is for very special people.
Okay, sorry. This week, Angela has chosen the topic, well, of course she has, because it's about shopping. And I know you girlies love all that.
Oh, there he goes, our feminist spokesperson once again, John O'Farrell. Though, yes, it is about shopping, sort of. It's also about the places we shop.
Shops?
Smart ass.
I see. Why have you chosen this topic?
So, well, John, regular listeners will know that I love a bit of 20th century architecture.
Yes, and Patreon members, going back to that again, they'll know that they had to sit through endless photos of housing estates in Berlin that Angela had insisted on sharing with us.
Join our Patreon, folks, for incredible content like that.
What was your celebrity mastermind specialist subject again?
British Brutalist Architecture.
Rock and roll.
Look, I'm just fascinated with the design of buildings that we often take for granted. So right. I am a member of the 20th Century Society. And recently I attended two webinars because I know how to have a good time. One about department stores and one about shopping centres.
Angela doesn't have many friends. So your days of smoking crack in a car park really are behind you, aren't they?
I do still hang around car parks, Sean, but mostly just check out the architecture. Actually, because I'm often found mooching about housing estates and civic buildings, I recently ordered this T-shirt that says, "I'm not a burglar, I'm looking at the architecture."
Good cover for a burglar.
Yeah. Anyway, these lectures that I attended were a really interesting look at the changing architecture of department stores and shopping centres and how they sort of reflected the changing fashions for how we shop. And I thought it'd be a good topic for We Are History.
Yes. Well, and it's quite timely because we're going through quite seismic changes in the way we shop right now, aren't we? Can't open the paper without there being a headline screaming at you about the death of the high street.
Yeah, I mean, the death of the high street's been in the papers for as long as I can remember, but yeah, absolutely. Physical shops obviously are struggling because of the rise in online shopping, particularly after the pandemic lockdowns. I think there's a lot of people who resisted online shopping, like to go to physical shops. But during the lockdowns, they had to use online shopping. Then they sort of got on board with it and got used to it. And now it's all over. They've continued shopping online, even though the shops have reopened. Now, I started researching about our shopping habits, John. And unsurprisingly, it's a huge topic because acquiring goods for money or bartering or however you acquire goods that you haven't grown yourself is something that human beings have had to do in various forms since around 6000 BC.
Oh, bloody hell, here we go. Strap yourself in, guys. It's going to be a long one.
Don't panic. So what I've done, I've just picked out the bits that I think are really interesting.
Oh God, there's going to be lots of talk about concrete and curtain walls.
Yeah, there is going to be some talk about the architecture of the places we shop, John. It's interesting, honest, trust me. But also I thought we could look at the trends and behaviour of shoppers and how it's changed over the time. And I'm going to concentrate just on the last 200 years or so, so mainly 20th century. Okay. So my sources for this episode are the two lectures that I attended. One, the shopping centre one was given by Ellie Brown, who's a PhD student at the University of Warwick studying shopping centres. And the other was about department stores, and that was given by Matthew Whitfield, who's an architectural investigator at Historic England.
Oh.
And I also read a book called Back to the Shops, The High Street in History and the Future by Rachel Bowlby. And I read lots of different articles.
You've done a lot of work for this, Angela.
I got into it a bit to the detriment of my social life, it has to be said.
Let no one pretend that we don't do some work for this podcast.
I basically cancelled my weekend plans and really went down some rabbit holes with this one. But I've enjoyed it, so that's fine. So, John, Rachel Bowlby, in her book, she describes what she calls the five stages of shopping history. So do you want to tell us what they are?
Well, I've got them written down here. Peddlers, markets and fairs. 2, small shops. 3, chains and some very big shops. 4, self-service and supermarkets. 5, online shopping.
That's right. And as she points out, it's not a linear history as such. For example, types of shops don't disappear when supermarkets arrive, for example. But fashions and behaviour change as time goes on.
You left out shoplifting on that list, actually, which was something I was quite into when I was 11 years old.
If the listeners had to pick which one of us indulged in shoplifting as a teenager, they would 100% pick me. And I have never shoplifted in my life.
You're a good girl.
I was a good girl.
Let's do a brief skip through the first and second stages and then concentrate on what came next then.
Okay, so until the Middle Ages, really, most people consumed what they could grow on their land or could trade with their neighbours.
Yeah.
And markets were the places where you could get things that you couldn't provide yourself. So the concept of markets goes back to ancient times, really. The Domesday Book lists 50 markets in England, although that's probably quite an underestimate. It's probably quite a lot more. And from the 12th century, English monarchs awarded a charter to local lords to create markets and fairs for a town or village, which meant a rival fair couldn't operate nearby on the same day.
Right. So what's the difference then between a market and fairs? Is it markets, you could buy fake designer smocks, and in fairs, you could win a goldfish to feed your family?
Not exactly, John. Fairs were annual events dealing in more luxury goods, usually linked to a religious festival, whereas markets were weekly or bi-weekly and they sold fresh produce and the necessities that you need.
So fairs were Debenhams, markets were Lidl.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, markets and fairs still exist, of course, although most of the markets where I used to buy knockoff trainers and five lighters for a pound are now selling loaves of bread for a fiver and cheese that will rot the inside of your nostrils out. But
it's a bit like that Clapham Market on the Saturday. I go down there and go, how much is that bit of cheese? That's £100. Oh, super.
It used to be somewhere where you bought knockoff designer goods in those plastic red and white striped carrier bags.
That's right,
take it home.
Happy days.
Yeah.
Markets were subject to rules and were only operational on certain days. So in order to extend the time they could sell things, people began trading in the places where they manufactured or grew the goods they were selling. Is that right?
That's right. So yeah, shops were essentially on farms or where people made things in their workshops.
Yeah.
But eventually the shop as a selling place only and not a place of manufacture that also sold the stuff slowly separated off. So early shops were often attached to where the shopkeeper lived.
Yeah, these house shops were still common in the 19th and 20th centuries. And of course, living over the shop is still common for local shops.
Yeah, absolutely. So then in the late 1700s, a particular style of covered marketplace that had been popular on the continent was popping up in Britain, which was known as an arcade, where you could do your shopping without being rained on.
And play Space Invaders.
Not that sort of arcade.
My computer game reference is up to date there. Space Invaders, I'm bang on it.
John's never been bothered by Lara Croft. He's still playing Space Invaders. One of the first of these covered market arcades was in Oxford, and they were built really to tidy the place up a bit, to sort of hide away this collection of higgledy-piggledy market stalls that would clutter up the streets.
Right.
So anyway, let's skip forward a bit now, John, to the 1800s and what was going on around this time, John.
Oh, I know this. Industrialisation, miss.
Gold star for you, John O'Farrell. Or was it just O'Farrell at your school?
O'Farrell. What, sir?
Now, as we know, industrialisation really changed the whole structure of society, where and how people lived, particularly ordinary working people.
Yes, people now move into where factories were. That meant new towns and villages springing up.
Yeah, and it meant those people working in these new industries had neither the land to produce what they needed, as they all lived much closer together, nor the time, as they were too busy working.
So what would happen then is that a shop selling necessities would open in these places, but it would be controlled by the owners of the factories or mills or mine, the bastards.
Yeah.
So this meant that they could set the prices of goods to whatever they liked. And if you work there, they just deduct the cost of what you bought directly from workers' wages.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 1844, a group of tradesmen, they decided to get together and they called themselves the Rochdale Society of Equitable Pioneers.
It's catchy, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? And they decided that they would open their own store selling food items that they themselves would otherwise not be able to afford, sort of to each other. And they were governed by a set of rules that they called the Rochdale Principles. And this became the basis for what became known as the cooperative movement.
Yeah, and a co-op was like a radical force for social and economic change, wasn't it? Especially in the northern industrial towns where, as we said, provision of shops was limited and virtually monopolistic by the capitalist bastards.
Yes, capitalist bastards, exactly. And eventually these co-ops, they sold not just food, but most household goods that you'd need, clothing, boots and shoes, chemist items, furniture, and then even travel and funeral services.
Yeah, co-op's still going, isn't it? I mean, they never made the move into a massive out-of-town superstores like your Tesco's or your Sainsbury's. They sort of remained local and community-based.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, back to the mid-1800s, and another development changed the way we shop pretty significantly. John, it's your favourite thing about this era.
Rickets?
No, the other favourite thing.
Oh, trains!
Yes! The railway network, of course, that meant that not only could people travel to shops that were further than they could walk, but also, more importantly, goods could travel further.
Yes.
So trains could get even perishable goods a much further distance, much quicker than horses and carts could.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that increased the range of products that was available for people in different areas to buy.
So this is when the concept of the high street, as we know today, started to form, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. The name high street in a town had been around since the 12th century, and it really just meant the most important street. It had higher status than the others.
Right, yeah, I never thought about that before, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people often think it's to do with
hills.
Where it is and hills and things, but no, it's to do with status. So as market stores and peddlers began to move into shops with fixed locations rather than market stores, the high street we recognise started to form.
Yeah.
And we also start to see different kinds of shops that we recognise. For example, in 1884, there was a Polish refugee called Michael Marx, and he opened his penny bazaar.
Ah, the pound shop of its day.
Yes, indeed. And that was in Kirkgate Market in Leeds. So it started off as a covered market stall in a covered market, and then it became a sort of shop unit. And then eventually he invited a bookkeeper named Thomas Spencer into business with him, and they became, of course,
Freeman, Hardy and Willis.
Very funny. So Marx and Spencer opened the first Marks and Spencer shop in 1894.
And immediately someone brought something back because it was the wrong size.
Yes. Yes.
And this is an example of another shopping development of the era, the chain store.
Yeah, though chain store is a rather vulgar American term.
Oh, I'm sorry.
John, they weren't known as that in Britain until quite a bit later. At this time, they called them multiples.
Okay, I see what they did there. By the end of the 19th century, some of these multiples, they had multiple branches, didn't they?
Yeah.
Dozens of them, even a few, maybe hundreds.
Some had hundreds. A few of them had hundreds. So most multiples were dairies or grocers, and most of them were regional. But there were some non-food multiples and some that were national, even. One of the most famous of them that we still recognise today grew largely thanks to your favourite thing again, John.
Castles.
The other one?
Trains.
That's the one. Yep, good old W.H. Smith's. They originally opened a shop in 1792, but then they developed as a chain of station newsagents when the railways came about, opening their first railway station newsstand in Euston Station in 1848.
So even in the 1850s, some spotty youth would be trying to upsell you a chocolate bar with your copy of Telegraph.
Your what, John?
Guardian.
I think that's a good place to take a break, and I'm going to make a start on that huge dairy milk that you were upsold this morning at Clapham Junction, John.
See you in a minute. Okay, welcome back to We Are History, where Angela is taking us on a shopping trip through history, and I'm seated by the metaphorical fitting rooms, minding the bags and looking at the football results on my phone.
Ah, stereotypes, John. But stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason, and that brings us on to this, that the women of the 19th and early 20th century actually used the word shopping themselves to mean a distinctly feminine pursuit.
See, I wasn't being sexist, Angela.
No, from the late 18th century, there's this quite important distinction was being made between doing the shopping and going shopping.
Right. Doing the shopping is about providing necessities for your family. Going shopping is a sort of leisure pursuit for people with no soul.
Yeah. Do you know, it's something I've never really understood. People who choose to spend their valuable weekends going shopping.
Yes.
We used to do it when I was a kid. It'd be like, we'll go to the shops and all we'd do is look at stuff we couldn't afford.
Yeah.
When I have to go to a shop, like if I've got to buy an outfit for a wedding and I need to try it on or whatever, Generally, I hate it. There's too many people. I can't do queues. I've got ADHD. It causes me physical pain to stand in a queue. And then I get this burning anger. I'm restless and fidgety. And then when someone dithers at the counter, it's all I can do not to lamp them. I hate it.
You're so like my wife.
Am I?
Yeah. Because I Jackie and I say, let's cycle up the King's Road from Clapham and just go and, well, what to buy? Well, we get one around the clothes shops maybe. And she's like, why would I want to do that? She hates it. Her idea of hell is being stuck in, you know, Primark Oxford Street.
Oh my God.
On Christmas Eve or
something.
I think
as you get older as well. I think I used to like it more when I was younger, but now I just cannot. But thank God for online shopping. That's what I say. Anyway, shops. One of the biggest changes to happen in shopping at this time was this idea of it being a day out.
Yeah.
And lots of middle class women, of course, because they were the people who had fuck all to do, let's be honest.
Disposable income, yeah.
Well, it's more about the time. What were they doing with their time? So they were going shopping, not with the primary need of getting food to feed their family, but for leisure.
Yeah, you see it in literature, don't you? I remember in Pride and Prejudice that Bennett's sister talk of visiting their aunt in London, and the round of entertainment they enjoy includes an evening at the theatre and some bustle and shopping.
Yeah, there you go. So shopping as this leisurely pursuit has started to be an idea. But it was also an important development in women's rights, sort of, to be serious about it, because we've discussed this before. But at the time, there were few places outside the home where women could exist unchaperoned.
Yes.
And the lack of public conveniences in towns made it difficult for women to be out of the home for too long. So these new department stores that were being built, they became fashionable because they provided facilities for women. Right. They had toilets. Proprietors knew that women were desperate for somewhere respectable
to go
on their own. And that included suffragists and suffragettes who needed places to gather where there were no men.
Right.
And so department store proprietors provided it for them, because by having loos and places to eat and things like that, it meant women would spend far more time and therefore far more money in their shops.
Right. So when you said places to go, I thought it meant go for a wee. But well, no, just generally. that's very interesting. What exactly is a department store and why is it different from other shops, Angela? You're the expert.
So this lecturer, this webinar I went to, Matthew Whitfield, he argued that really a department store is a sort of privately owned civic building. It had a different function to other shops. They are for shopping, but they're also meeting and gathering places. Unlike other shops at the time, it was easy to visit them without actually purchasing anything. You could just go and browse and go to the cafe, go to the toilet, you know. But to answer your question, what is a department store? Retail historians tend to use a definition that was given by a James B. Jeffries, who wrote a book in 1954 called Retail Trading in Britain, 1850 to 1950. No, I didn't read it. And
you didn't, knowing you.
Well, I couldn't find it. But that defined the department store as, and I quote, a large retail store with four or more separate departments under one roof, each selling different classes of goods, of which one is women's and children's wear.
Okay, so the catch-all term department store wasn't in general use at this time then?
No, not until well into the 20th century.
The stores were known by their proprietors' names, weren't they? Or as draperies. They often began life as a draper's.
Yeah, they sort of often grew out of other types of shops.
Yeah.
Sometimes they were called emporiums or universal stores. They had all sorts of names at the time.
So what is officially the first department store, Angela?
Well, that's quite difficult to nail. There's lots of claims to be the first department store in the world and to be the first in Britain. And I struggled to find a source with a definitive answer.
Right.
Le Bon Marché in Paris is quite a strong contender for being the first department store under Jeffrey's definition.
Right.
And that opened on the Rive Gauche in Paris in 1838.
How are you on the Rive Gauche? She says you're so fashionable.
Oui, oui. I'm never away from the Rive Gauche, me. And according to Matthew Whitfield, who gave the lecture, it's the Bon Marché in Brixton, which was modelled on that Parisian store of the same name, has a good claim to be Britain's first purpose-built department store. So they did exist before that, but they grew out of other types of store that extended.
Brixton had Britain's first department store, Dunmore Manor. Wow. The key thing about department stores, of course, is to do with the idea of the sort of theatre and the glamour of front of house. They really had to focus on, you know, attentive service to the customer.
Yeah, absolutely. They had a highly efficient economic structure, department stores, which is based on low profit margins and high sales volume and fast turnover.
Yeah.
Of course, the same model, really, that a century later supermarkets would work on, except instead of high fashion and luxury, it was ordinary food at minimum prices.
Yeah. One of the innovations of the department store was that they showed off the goods that were for sale. Mm. You didn't have to ask to see what they had. They had their wares all out on display for you to look at. the harlots. I mean, it seems obvious now, doesn't it? But
yeah.
It wasn't.
Things were, you know, a counter and sort of hidden away. The Argos model, if you like.
Right.
There wasn't even a catalogue. So technically, anybody, not just the rich, could come in and have a look around without the obligation to make a purchase. That's something quite different. Though I'm not sure how often sort of poor people were coming out of the mills and hopping on a train to go and look at stuff they could never afford in a million years. But they could if they wanted to.
And on that note, that was another innovation, wasn't it? The prices were on display too. You didn't have to ask how much something cost.
Yeah, I don't know about you, John, but I adopt a strict, if it doesn't say how much it is, I'm not buying it policy when I'm shopping.
It's like,
my dad used to go, if it's not got a price in it, it's free.
If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Exactly. So there's loads of department stores springing up across the country at this time. I've selected a couple to talk about here. They are both in London.
We'll get letters, Angela.
We won't, John. It's 2024. But it's just that they have particularly interesting stories, these two that I'm focusing on. The first one was Whiteley's.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you the story of Whiteley's. Okay. It's quite interesting. In 1855, when he was just 24, William Whiteley travelled to London from his home in Yorkshire and took up a drapery apprenticeship.
Okay.
And over 6 years as a draper, he saved £700 and opened a draper's shop in the then quite unfashionable suburb Bayswater.
Okay.
And his business grew over 20 years with him buying more and more property in the area. And he eventually had an empire covering 14 acres.
Wow. He sold a whole range of goods, didn't he? His slogan was everything from a pin to an elephant.
And of course, if you bought a pin and an elephant, you could play pin the tail in the elephant.
Who bought an elephant? I mean, do you know what? I was actually watching a nature programme last night and there was a baby elephant on it. And I said, oh, we'd love to have a baby elephant, wouldn't it, Jackie? And she said, yeah, but people don't realise how big they grow.
Victorians, though, did have elephants in their gardens, didn't they? In fact, there's Lewis Carroll had a house in Brighton.
Oh, yeah.
In Sussex Square, I think it's called. And he kept, I don't know if it was his elephant, but there were elephants in the, so there's like a locked garden and people who live in Sussex Square get a key to the locked garden in the middle of the square. Yeah. And I had a friend who rented a flat there, so she had a key. And we used to go in there and there's a tunnel from the gardens down that leads down to the sea. And it's still open, the tunnel, but you need a key to get into it.
Wow.
And you right down to the beach. And it's where they took the elephants that were in the garden down to drink water.
They drank seawater.
Because obviously elephants drink seawater,
they
John.
Themselves with it,
I don't think Victorians were bothered about what elephants actually did.
It's the elephant tunnel.
So, yeah, it's the elephant tunnel. The Lewis, and it's thought to be what he based the rabbit hole on. There you go.
Interesting. Learn something.
A little aside there.
So, we were talking about Whiteley's, weren't we?
Yes, we were.
Became the leading London department store. Mm. It went public on the London Stock Exchange in 1899.
It did. But Whiteley himself was a ruthless and deeply unpleasant man. He overtook the area, undercut local traders. His shop had at least 5 serious arson attacks. He employed over 6,000 staff. Most of them lived in staff accommodation. They worked from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. 6 days a week.
Sounds almost as bad as working at Sports Direct.
Yeah.
They didn't have any choice, did they?
No, compulsory living in was the norm at the time and something shop workers often protested about. And in 1901, there was a strike of 13 Whiteley's shop assistants. Yeah. And they paraded through Oxford Street in top hats. And they sparked a wave of sympathy. Pathetic actions. So by the time the First World War came around, most employers had quite reluctantly conceded to the shop workers' right to a rise in wages in lieu of board and lodging so they could live where they wanted to.
Yeah, all shop workers at the time were pretty exploited, but Whiteley was sort of on another level, wasn't he?
He was. He was a bully, a tyrant, a philanderer. He sexually harassed the shop girls. He was pretty grim. His wife eventually sued for divorce on the grounds of cruelty and adultery.
It all caught up with him, though, on the 24th of January, 1907, when a man called Horace Rayner, who claimed to be his illegitimate son, turned up and shot him twice in the head, killing him instantly.
Yeah, and Rayner was sentenced to death. But when the truth came out about what sort of man Whiteley was, public sympathy was very much on Rayner's side and his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment.
Yeah, his sons tried to keep the store going, but in 1912 it was sold to a certain Mr. Selfridge.
Yes, arguably one of the most famous department stores. And if you like a bit of Sunday night telly, you probably already know about the man Harry Selfridge.
Was he on Songs of Praise or something?
No, you're thinking of Harry Secombe and it was Highway he was on. Not songs of praise. No, I'm talking about Mr. Selfridge, the Sunday night drama about the life of Harry Gordon Selfridge. Did you ever watch it?
Never watched that one, Angela. Sorry.
No, I didn't either. My mum watched it. And fun fact, I used to live in a flat above one of the actors that was in it.
Oh, right.
And my mum came to visit me once and sort of bumped into him in the communal hallway. She was completely beside herself. She came into my flat going, oh my God, Mr. Grove's out there. So like, what are you talking about? I don't know what she was banging on about. Anyway, Selfridges.
Do they?
What?
Selfridges.
Oh, John. Famously not, no. After a visit to London in 1906, American Harry Gordon Selfridge invested £400,000, which is equivalent to nearly $61 million today, in a new department store at the then quite scummy end of Oxford Street.
Wow.
It was designed by Daniel Burnham. He'd also designed the famous Marshall Field department store in Chicago. And Francis Swales was the man who worked on the decorative detail, that famous monumental elevation at the front that drew on sort of ancient Rome and late 19th century France.
She's banging on about architecture again.
I am. Yeah. But it's important, though, because it set new standards, really, and it was innovative. This frontage was designed to draw customers in, and the interior was really innovative. It was the basis of what later became known as the horizontal system. So up to this point, most department stores had central stairwells.
Right.
Taking you up to the different floors. But in Selfridges, the stairs were at either end, and this created an uninterrupted shop floor with as much selling space as possible, including in the middle bit where the stairs weren't.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yes. And he also introduced a lot of American-style marketing techniques. Selfridges' opening was launched with a huge fanfare. He commissioned 38 of London's top illustrators to draw a full-page, half-page and quarter-page ads for 18 newspapers.
Yeah. And from the day it opened, Selfridges was this social and cultural phenomenon, really. They played live music from string quartets. There was soft lighting. The customers were called guests.
Wow.
Selfridges would have all sorts of events and stunts to bring people through the doors.
Yeah, in its opening year, Louis Blériot's monoplane was put on display at Selfridges after the first cross-channel flight, where it had been seen by 12,000 people.
Yeah. Incredible. And this was high-end retail therapy at its most luxurious. Mr. Selfridge loved these gimmicks and he loved a catchphrase. In fact, it might have been him that gave us the customer is always right.
Right.
Although there's a bit of debate about that. It could also have been Marshall Field. But Mr. Selfridge is responsible for only so many shopping days till Christmas. Ugh, it's his fault. We have only 10 shopping days till Christmas.
God. I do remember reading a book about the London Underground, and he lobbied hard to have Bond Street Station have its name changed to Selfridges.
Ooh.
But he actually, like in the way that Arsenal Station is named after the ground, but he failed on that because they're thinking, well, what if it becomes another shop? We'll have to change the name of the station to Sports Direct or the Body Shop or whatever. But anyway, if you weren't rich enough to shop in Selfridges, there was something for everyone, because also in 1909, in Liverpool, the first FW Woolworths opened.
Oh, rest in peace. I bloody miss Woolies, don't you, John?
It was based on the US five and dime stores and originally sold goods that cost no more than 6 old pence.
Oh. Miss it, I do. There's one in Berlin, a Woolworths.
Still?
And I always just, when I see it, I'm just like, oh, takes me back. Then, of course, in 1914, along came a little thing called World War One that once again turned everything in retail upside down.
Wait, what? There was a war? A World War One? We'll have to find out about that one day. Yes, when the news that war had been declared in August 1914 hit the British public, they did the only thing they knew how to do in a crisis. They started panic buying.
Yep, didn't start with COVID, John. We've always been a nation of panic buyers. Did you panic buy when the pandemic happened, John?
I was in America when COVID struck. So I was walking around going, oh, look at all these toilet rolls. I wanted to send them home. It was very different. I was busy losing investors in my musical, $20 million.
I should have brought it up. Sorry, John, touchy subject.
I'm triggered, Angela, to be honest.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
People were hoarding food, and because imports were pretty much cut off during the war, Britain's agricultural resources couldn't meet the demand of the people. By 1918, prices had risen by 100%.
Wow.
And also, shops lost loads of staff as young men went off to fight.
Yeah, so one of the main differences in the retail sector at this time was that women flooded into those jobs.
Yeah.
By 1917, the number of women in grocers and bakers' shops had risen by 56%.
Yeah.
Interesting stat for you there.
Absolutely. Then after the First World War, between 1919 and 1928, the building of department stores resumed.
Right.
Selfridges had set this template for their interior design with this horizontal system.
Yep.
There were variations, particularly on the exteriors. Classicism and Neo-Georgian styles were still popular. There started to be signs of this modernism coming in, especially in the smaller stores beyond the big cities.
Right.
And these interwar years saw a quick consolidation of the department store sector. So a lot of them changed from being local family businesses to coming under the umbrella of larger retail groupings. A lot of them we still have today, John Lewis Partnership, Lewis, right. You know, all those sorts of...
Unemployment was high during the interwar period, but because of the advances in marketing and advertising, the multiples and department stores were sort of booming.
They were. They did all sorts to get people through the door. Bentalls of Kingston ran mannequin parades and Bonnie Baby competitions. Alders of Croydon imported a baby elephant. It's the elephants again. They loved an elephant, the Victorians.
They did.
So they imported a baby elephant to advertise its jumbo sale. Oh, get it? See what they did? And Derry and Toms in Kensington opened a roof garden complete with flamingos.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
In 1925, John Logie Baird made the first public demonstration of moving silhouette images by television from the first floor of Selfridges.
Yeah. Selfridges, they had a mini golf and even had an all-girl gun club.
Blimey. You wouldn't tell your wife trying on a dress that bum looked big in there, would you?
No, you wouldn't, John. So Selfridges really prospered up to the mid-1930s when the Great Depression took its toll, particularly on Harry Gordon Selfridge himself. He was a lavish spender. He was a gambler. He'd run up a £150,000 debt to the store.
Wow.
By 1940, he owed £250,000 in taxes, which in 1940 was
a
hell of a lot of money,
yeah.
And was in debt to the bank. So the Selfridges board forced him out in 1941. He was in his 80s then.
Wow.
And the original Oxford Street Selfridges was acquired by the Liverpool-based Lewis's chain of department stores.
Right. 8th of May 1947, Selfridge himself died of bronchial pneumonia at his home in Putney, southwest London. He was 89 years old.
Yeah. And of course, prior to that,
yes,
World War II,
yes,
was going on, and that also had a pretty massive effect on shops and shopping.
Yes, food rationing meant that traders had a whole load of directives and regulations to deal with. Customers had to register with specific shops to supply them with the rationed goods they were entitled to.
Yeah, what that often meant was that smaller shops tended to lose out to larger shops because if you had to register with the shop to get your ration goods, you're going to go to the one that offers a wider range of items.
Of
so as the war progressed, rationing was extended to more and more types of goods.
Yeah, December 41, the government introduced a point system to offer some limited choice of non-perishable foods, depending on what happened to be available at the time. Clothing rationing was introduced in June 41.
Yeah, so the war saw this shift in the balance of power between customer and shopkeeper. We've gone from customer is always right and all the power is with the customer, but suddenly the shopkeeper has this power when rationing comes. So, for example, a shopkeeper could hold back a product that was in short supply for their more favoured customers.
Yeah,
you know.
But prices were regulated and profiteering was punished by fines or prison sentences.
Yeah, lots of shops struggled to survive the war.
Yeah, the Co-op was innovative in its approach to survival, though. In a 1942 experiment necessitated by wartime staff shortages, a self-service shop was created on the ground floor of Co-op in Romford, Essex.
Yeah, now self-service stores, that's where you pick the items off the shelf yourself rather than ask for them at a counter.
Yeah.
They've been popular in the US in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
There was briefly one in Turnpike Lane in London in 1923.
Yeah.
But Co-op were the first to properly try out this format that would eventually become the supermarket. But then it was known as queueless shopping.
Oh, okay. Several department stores were requisitioned in the Second World War. Kendall Milne in Manchester housed civil servants. The basement of Arnold's in Great Yarmouth was converted into a military hospital. Other stores had public shelters in their basements.
Yeah, including Selfridges. And not only was their basement used as an air raid shelter, but from 1943, the huge Six Alley scrambling apparatus, which was used to secure the transatlantic phone calls between the US and British officials, including Churchill and Roosevelt themselves, against eavesdropping, was housed in the basement of Selfridges.
Cool.
Yeah.
The post-war period brought a huge amount of change in the way our towns and cities looked as bomb cities like Coventry needed to be rebuilt, new homes provided.
Yeah, we've talked a fair bit in previous podcast episodes about post-war planning and rebuilding because it's, you know, thing I'm into. We did an episode on the Greenbelt, and our episode on the rise and fall of the Council House talks a lot about Patrick Abercrombie's plans for rebuilding London and other places. It's one of my special interests, so I'm going to try and keep this not too nerdy.
Okay.
Lots of housing estates have been built before World War II in the interwar years. And these estates tended to have what we know as those little parades of shops, you know, like five or six shops in 1930s housing estates.
Yeah.
But the important thing about this post-war planning that I think is quite interesting is it's the first time, really, that the provision of shops was considered as an object of targeted planning in its own right, as targeted town planning. Where are the shops going to be? How many are they going to be? Where should they be in relation to housing and one another? How much provision was needed for cars and motorists? Where the neighbourhoods had too many shops?
Right. Yeah. Economists in the 30s had identified a problem of over-shopping, which doesn't mean too many people abusing their credit cards, but means too many shops in a location for the needs of the population.
Yeah. So we have at this time the New Towns Act, 1946, because not only were towns being rebuilt from being bombed, new towns were being built to build new housing and so on. So planners have this opportunity to start these towns from scratch, and they really start thinking about the best way to serve the community. Yeah. So the new towns like Stevenage or Crawley would have a substantial population, and they needed to be able to buy necessities. And it's important to remember that at this time, still only a few households had fridges even. Yeah. And the shops that sold perishable goods often didn't have fridges either.
Should have gone to Selfridges.
Should have gone to Selfridges.
People had to visit the shops daily. Having a car wasn't the norm yet either. So people had to be able to carry the shopping home, maybe using a pram or whatever. And this is why shops had to be near where people lived, in these new town centres or rebuilt town centres.
Yeah. So in the 50s, we start to see the building of these new shopping centres. And I don't mean like they are today, shopping centres, but centres of shopping, if you like. Yeah. Places where all the shops for a community were built together. And one of the most well-known names now in shopping centres, but at this time associated with building these early shopping centres, was Arndale.
Yes, they were called Arndale because the company was founded by Arnold Hagerback and Sam Chippendale.
Yeah. So what you're saying, John, is they could just as easily ended up being called Old Chip.
They could have been, Angela.
Old Chip.
Yeah, yeah.
Arndale.
Maybe. Anyway. Maybe, but maybe not.
Yeah. Arndale flows off the tongue better.
It does, anyway.
So the original Arndales, before they built the big enclosed shopping centres they're famous for now, sort of bridged the gap between these old shopping parades in the 30s estates and the shopping precinct. This was a kind of in the middle of those things. So they were building these sort of stretches of high streets in the form of sort of canopied concrete shopping parades.
Yeah.
If you know, can you visualise what
just
I mean?
Just about, yeah.
And they were building them in small towns across the north. The first one was in Jarrow in County Durham.
Oh, yes.
And then came the shopping precincts. And these were bigger. They were like a kind of designed town centre.
Yes.
Groups of shops together in one place, because the days of cities with a haphazard layout and illogical town centres were thought to be a thing of the past.
Yes.
And British town centre precincts such as Stevenage were based on a 1953 project in Rotterdam, the Lijnbaan, which was the first purpose-built pedestrian street in Europe.
Right. It's interesting. When I was growing up in Maidenhead, what used to be a sort of square where you walked through shops became a precinct. But then it became closed off at night, security guards on it, and you had the feeling of public space being turned into private space. Mm. And I remember thinking at the time, no, this isn't on. The shops are taking away a place we used to cut through, and it used to be a place we used to hang out, and then we couldn't hang out there anymore.
Yeah.
These shopping precincts were pedestrianised areas, of course, with lots of concrete and sometimes with ramps to accommodate prams, and designed with something called pedestrian engineering in mind.
Yeah, pedestrian engineering basically means how do you get shoppers to go past as many shop frontages as possible as they go about their business. So the designs, like the one in Rotterdam, usually included public toilets, flower beds, litter bins, places to sit down, and public art. And I really love the sort of shopping precinct public art. I find it really... Have you heard of a sculpturer called William Mitchell or Bill Mitchell?
No, but I can guess from your enthusiasm what sort of artist he is.
They're concrete sculptures. So he would cast them in situ, and they're often on civic buildings. You see them, public buildings.
Yeah.
You've seen them, but you just don't really think about them because they kind of are built into this environment. But I love them.
Good. Well, I think we'll take a break there while Angela Googles some public art and I try and pretend that I like them too.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to We Are History, where we are still mooching around the shops of history while I'm moaning about being hungry and wanting to go to the pub.
As if I wouldn't rather be in a pub than a shop, John. But yes, here we are.
I was in a high street recently and I saw a pub with a sign saying husband parking area.
Oh, please. Sexist nonsense.
It is, isn't it?
So we were talking about the shiny new shopping precincts that popped up after the war, but they had their problems, John.
Was it concrete undercrofts that facilitated antisocial behaviour? I keep telling you that they're a bad idea.
Yeah, well, that was one of the problems. Another was that the precincts were often on two or more stories or levels, like right. The Merseyway Centre in Stockport. Yeah. You must know it, John. And it created this sort of wind tunnel effect that didn't make for a very pleasant shopping experience.
Yes. Meanwhile, in Sweden, British architect Ralph Erskine had built the first purpose-built indoor shopping centre in the world as a way to shop despite extreme weather.
Yeah, and that was soon followed in 1956 by the Southdale Centre in Edina, Minnesota, the first fully enclosed and climate-controlled shopping mall in the States, designed by Victor Gruen, who became known as the godfather of the mall. Do you think people have fallen asleep yet? I love this stuff. So we start now in the 50s to see the emergence of the modern shopping centre, and it started here in Britain in the 1960s.
Yeah, these precincts were soon overshadowed by enclosed shopping centres in towns and city centres, like the Bullring in Birmingham and Elephant and Castle in London.
Yeah. The Bullring in Birmingham opened on the 29th of May 1964 and was the first indoor city centre shopping centre in Britain. Right. It had 140 shop units. It had market stores, cafes, a ballroom, regular shows in the centre court. There was even a resident blue and gold macaw that was on loan from Dudley Zoo and had the very original name, Polly.
They worked hard on that, didn't they?
They did.
Yeah. It was late. It was Friday.
Polly?
It was Polly. Polly the Parrish. It had a 44-foot-wide electric screen outside displaying news and weather and sports results. But it didn't take long for people to start hating it, though, did they? By the 80s, people were moaning about its grey, brutalist design.
Philistines. I remember in 1990, I was 13 and a friend of mine had moved to Lichfield in Staffordshire and I went to visit her in the school holidays and her mum took us shopping in Birmingham and we went to the Bullring and I loved it. By then it was a figure of hate and everyone was going, oh, ugly thing. And I just thought, this place is amazing. And I remember I bought Suzanne Vega's Tom's Diner on 7-inch.
Oh, happy days. Wasn't one of the tables at your wedding named after the Bullring, Angela?
It was. Yeah, well, the tables at my wedding were named after either whiskies, because my husband loves a whiskey, or my favourite brutalist buildings.
Pretty standard for most weddings. It's in all the wedding etiquette books, I think you'll find, yeah.
Absolutely. So the mid-60s were the height of this comprehensive development in town and city centres, with shopping centres, civic centres, ring roads.
All the things Angela bloody loves, yes.
Yeah. Basically, I love the architecture of places that most people associate of where teenagers go to get fingered.
Thank you for that highbrow reference, anyway, Angela.
It's true. Something else was happening in the 60s, John.
The Beatles, drugs, John O'Farrell born in swinging Maidenhead.
Yeah, well, sort of. Because in the 60s, there was the emergence of the consumerist society.
Right.
Shopping for fun wasn't just a leisure activity for the richest in society anymore. In 1956, 2 years after the end of rationing, the Retail Price Index, do you want to explain what that is, John?
Oh, thanks a lot. You give me all the exciting bits. It measures the average change from month to month in the prices of goods and services purchased by most households in the UK.
Yeah, so in 1956, the Retail Price Index listed staples like lump sugar, rabbit, candles, turnips.
Boring.
But by the mid-60s, these have been replaced by camera films, telephone rentals, dog food, nylon stockings, sliced bread, fish fingers, jeans, motor scooters.
Far out, man.
Well, quite. So changes in fashion led to changes on the high street too. For example, girls and young women didn't want clothes in classic designs that were made to last anymore. Austerity was over, John.
Yep.
So disposable, fast fashion that we're familiar with and sort of reacting against now. Yeah. Begun. So in 1964, Topshop was born.
Okay. Supermarkets also boomed in the 1960s. Until 1964, resale price maintenance meant that manufacturers set the prices in the shops. But that was abolished in 64 by Ted Heath after some intense lobbying by Jack Cohen, the founder of Tesco.
Yeah, and this meant that supermarkets could now start to discount, which is one of the key reasons behind why they've got so much power over suppliers even today. Yes. Then as we move into the 70s, more of these closed shopping centres are appearing, some of them built for scratch, some by whacking a roof on those old precincts that have been built. But there was a problem with building all these shopping centres, John. Lots of people weren't fans even at the time.
The problem with building them in existing town centres is making them fit, I suppose. It's quite hard to do that without knocking down a few historical buildings.
Yeah, so planners tried different things to make buildings look more consciously integrated into their surroundings. Okay. So, for example, in 1972, when they built the Victoria Centre in Nottingham, they built it onto an existing railway station and sort of incorporated the existing ornate railway clock tower. But if you Google pictures of it, it didn't really work.
Yeah, it was described as an urban princess locked in chancery, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So from the mid-70s, they decided to try to make buildings look like they blended in different ways, like using materials and designs that match the historical buildings of the area.
Or to use like pastiche, like with Ealing Broadway, make the new buildings look like old ones, sort of mock Tudor, that sort of thing. That didn't really fool anyone, did it?
No, they tried. When they built Eldon Square Shopping Centre in Newcastle, they put a sort of reflective glass on the outside, the idea being that the existing buildings around it would be reflected onto its surface, helping to blend in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And while shopping centres were springing up, what was happening to the department stores, Angela?
Well, post-war, with all these newer ways of shopping, there wasn't a significant expansion of department stores in business terms. So most of the new department store developments at that time were just replacements for ones that had been bombed in the war, or renovation, or market repositioning. On the whole, the newer built department stores, although adopting some modernist style, like simplified elevations and clean lines, they tended not to be as overtly modernist as these new shopping centre buildings or civic centres or whatever. They were generally more conservative, a bit more ornate.
Right. There's a minor trend in post-war period for external sculpture on department stores, like Jacob Epstein's Liverpool Resurgent on the front of the old Lewis department store in the
city. Have you seen it? It's like this 5.5-metre high bronze statue above the entrance of Lewis's.
Right.
And it depicts a naked man standing on the prow of a ship, which sort of comes out of the front of the building, with his left arm stretched out and right arm raised as if calling. And apparently it's supposed to symbolise Liverpool's resurgence following the war, which is all very, you know, good and well, but it is known locally as Dickie Lewis.
Ah, Liverpool.
Yes.
One of the things that really changed the design of department stores and shopping centres that came about in the 70s and into the 80s, more and more people owning cars.
Not just people, John, but women.
Women are people, Angela.
And women were driving cars.
The world has gone mad now.
It's important, though, because as we know, John, only women shop.
This is true.
Men in supermarkets were still rarely, if ever at this point, seen in the shop planning literature.
Right.
So, in fact, back in the 60s, there was a survey of shoppers that was carried out on the high street in Leighton Buzzard. And they were doing a sort of feasibility study for a proposed new precinct. So on a Friday and Saturday, they spoke to 301 shoppers in the town, and they asked them where they'd travel from, what they were buying, all about their shopping habits and stuff. And not one of the people they spoke to was a man.
That's insane, isn't it? Is that because there were no men on the high street, or they just didn't bother speaking to them because whatever they were doing there, it couldn't possibly be shopping?
The latter, John. And of course, now women drove cars, they could use them to do the shopping. And in fact, there was a government report in the 80s that was called The Future of the High Street. And it described this new type of woman as, and I quote, a car-born working wife, which I think might be the title of my next tour.
Excellent.
I quite like that. Car-born working, Angela Barnes, car-born working wife.
So instead of visiting the shop every day, your housewife could now do a weekly shop in the car. That meant she could travel further to do it.
Yeah, which meant that shopping centres no longer had to be in town centres in walking distance from where people lived.
Yes.
So they could start moving them out a bit. And Brent Cross was the first out-of-town enclosed shopping centre in the UK. And it was revolutionary at the time.
Wow.
And also, it opened till 8 o'clock at night, so you could go after work because women also had jobs but still did the shopping.
Sounds fair enough to me. Remember back then, most of the shops still closed half day during a week. Banks closed at 3 p.m.
Yeah, so to have shops that were open till 8 p.m. was quite something. When Brent Cross opened, it had 75 stores, and it was built on this sort of concrete island surrounded by the Brent Cross flyover and the North Circular. And again, even at the time, I think it's quite majestic, but it wasn't seen as the most aesthetically pleasing structure in the world.
Yes.
The New Society magazine wrote about it in 1978, 2 years after it opened. John, you read it.
The massive and featureless rectangles of the Brent Cross Cross Shopping Centre come as no surprise. They are just as hideous as everything else, but step through the doors and here is prettiness and femininity, just as soulless and just as commercialised as the filth outside, but a veritable perfumed nirvana.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, great.
So at this time, out of necessity, this sort of symbiotic relationship forms between shopping centres and department stores.
Yeah, because department stores had traditionally been built in towns and city centres, so more people using their cars was a problem for them too, especially if shopping centres were pulling people away from town centres.
Yeah, and because department stores for the well-to-do, they had actually got ahead of the game a bit with car parks. Some of them had surface car parks as early as the 30s wow. because rich people had cars. And they were able to provide a lot more of them after the war, what with the help of the Luftwaffe having cleared a bit of space.
Yes, in the relatively few new department stores built in the post-war period, multi-storey car parks began to be integrated.
They did.
Selfridges built its car park in 1958.
Yeah. And other department stores built detached car parks nearby, like my favourite car park, because everyone's got one, John.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Don't know what yours is, but mine, it was on Welbeck Street, just north of Oxford Street. It was designed by Blampede and Partners in 1971, and it was built to serve the Debenhams flagship Oxford Street store. And it was this amazing tessellated concrete structure. It got demolished recently, and I'm still really sad about it. And look, I've got my bag with me today, which is, I've got a bag that's based on the design. See, that's the tessellation.
You should tweet
pretty,
that out
it?
When we put
I will
this
tweet out a picture
episode,
of it. And
Angela's
if you want,
bag.
It's a woman called Gail Myerscough. I don't know how you pronounce it. Myerscough, Myerscough. I'm sorry, Gail. We follow each other on Twitter and I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce your surname. But her website is Myerscough. And her
bag.
Website is brilliant if you're into modernist design and you want, like, I've got a phone cover with the fort and tower from the M6 services on it and all sorts of things. So,
wasn't
yeah.
one of your tables at your wedding named after it by any chance?
It was. There was a Welbeck Street table, but you weren't sat at that one, John, because no. I reserved that for my lovely friend Gareth E. Rees, who's an author, and he wrote a book called Car Park Life. It's about retail car parks, but it's also about life. It's a sort of, it's really good. It's,
I'll read it.
So what happened is department stores teamed up with shopping centres. From the 1970s, new department stores were built as anchor tenants in town centre and out-of-town shopping centres.
Right, so being an anchor tenant comes from an American idea that means a business that is an occupant in a retail centre, but one that draws people in and drives business for other tenants in that retail centre, yeah? Mm. So, for example, the original three department stores when Brent Cross opened were, and still are, in fact, Fenwick's, John Lewis and Marks and Spencer. Big department stores lure customers into the shopping centre and in return they get the car parking and other facilities associated with being a tenant in a shopping centre.
Yeah, so it's this sort of symbiotic relationship. Yeah. And if you think about all the big shopping centres, they've all got big department stores in.
Yeah, yeah.
A drawback of being an anchor tenant in a shopping centre rather than having your own separate store is it can be difficult to imprint your store's personality
right.
onto the building. You know, you're just another shop in a store. But there are ways to do it. And in 1976, when Eldon Square Shopping Centre was built in Newcastle, John Lewis was the anchor tenant.
Yep.
And to make their mark, they built an elevated cafe inside. So the John Lewis Cafe was this structure inside the shopping centre. And I've popped a picture in our notes so John can see it. But do
it
Google
look,
it. It's really cool.
It does look amazing.
It looks like a spaceship.
It looks like a concrete cafe inside a shopping centre to
me. It doesn't. It looks like a spaceship, John. Stop pissing on my dreams.
As we move into the 21st century, shopping really moves out of towns, even more with massive shopping centres.
Yeah, there are these destination shopping centres springing up, like Meadowhall in Sheffield, Lakeside in Essex in 1990, and the Trafford Centre in Manchester in 1998. Actually, this reminds me of a joke my dad used to tell. What's an Essex girl's favourite wine?
Go on.
I want to go to Lakeside.
Oh, that sort of wine. I see what they're doing there.
We also start to see outlet villages like Bicester Village that was built in 1995.
Yes.
But as the new millennium hits, so does another big change in the way we shop.
The Kay's catalogue.
Well, yes, that, but on a slightly larger scale, the internet. Oh, you don't strike me as coming from a catalogue family,
no,
will you,
no,
John?
No, I don't think
no,
so.
No, I don't think
drive
so,
up
no.
To London and you're shopping in London.
So in 1995, from a garage in Seattle, Amazon sold their first book online and started a tide that couldn't be turned back.
Yes, the future of physical shops is at quite a turning point at the moment for lots of reasons. The internet, the financial crisis. There's also the effects of COVID-19 and people being more ecologically aware, wanting to move away from fast fashion and so on.
Yeah, we're more conscious now of the miles the things we buy have travelled and how we travel to get them. Yeah. And younger people are becoming more conscious of waste and so on. And more recently, there's been another change in shopping centres to try to ensure their survival.
Yeah.
They're looking more now to what an apprentice candidate might call the experience economy, rather than the retail economy. So shopping centres now, these big new ones like your Westfields or whatever, have cinemas and gaming and proper restaurants, not just an arcade machine and a spud you like they used to have.
People spend the day and the evening in shopping centres and retail parks where you might, you know, also find a bowling alley and a Nando's or something.
Exactly. I find them quite soulless, but they're good. Yeah. I think if you've got kids, you know, you could go there, spend the day there. And so that's how shopping centres are adapting to cope. However, while there's a cost of living crisis for most of us, there is a section of society that is just getting richer and richer, John. And what is the point of being super rich if you're going to do all your shopping online, if you can't be seen shopping in the most expensive shops?
Yes.
So we now have places like what's happened to Battersea Power Station being turned into these high-end luxury shops where rich people can spend money and wannabe influencers can take selfies for Instagram to pretend they're important.
Yes.
Have you been, John? It's basically your local shop.
It's just up the road from me. I've sort of passed that sort of all the time. And before, if I wanted a Rolex or a Ferrari, I had to go out to Heathrow to do my shopping. But now it's just up the road and they've got all these fantastic high-end brands that I would never use ever. So it's a bit of a shame that that building isn't. I mean, it sort of was a derelict site before, I know, but it would have been nicer if it was something we actually wanted or could use.
And that all people could use.
Yeah.
I remember my dad once dated this very posh lady who lived in Knightsbridge. My dad was very much her bit of rough.
Right.
And she used to call Harrods was her local shop. She used to call it H.A. Rods.
Okay.
And like it didn't last, them dating. I met her a few times, but it didn't last. I can remember my dad giving her her face when my dad gave her a box of mint matchmakers. I just remember that.
Yes.
Anyway, so there we go. That's it. A bit of a romp through British retail history.
Yes.
Obviously, as always, there's loads we didn't have time for. So do read that book that I mentioned at the top. There'll be a reading list. I'll put on there a couple of the articles that I read and stuff as well.
Yeah.
You could do a whole episode, for example, just on the history of supermarkets or Harrods. But I think we've had a bit of a good overview of what shopping's looked like in Britain over the last couple of centuries.
Exactly. It's been a little bit of history, a little bit of sociology, little bit of architectural history.
A little bit of sexism.
A little bit of sexism.
Yeah.
You
all
put
the
that into my script to make me look sexist. We should do a shout out for the fantastic Patreon supporters who
should.
This.
We've got some today. Shall I start the ball rolling? We have Lindsay Godfrey.
Stefan Bregg.
We have, what an incredible name, Storm Candro Moon.
Fantastic. And then we've got Milena.
Lovely. Thank you so much. Don't forget you can give us reviews on Apple Podcasts if that's how you listen, because that helps us get up the old algorithms.
Tell your friends.
You can join our Patreon. Please tweet about us. Put us on your social media, not just Twitter, Instagram. We're on Instagram. We are History Pod. Do come and join us over there. And hello to lovely Martha, who looks after our Instagram. That's all for this week, John.
Thanks very much, Angela, for that. Walk through the windy shopping centre, the smell of urine in the multi-storey car park.
Lovely.
And I've come away with some cuddly toy that I didn't know I wanted. See you next week.
Bye.
We Are History was written and presented by Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell. The producer was me, Simon Williams. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. Socials were by Kieran Leslie. And artwork was by James Parrott. We Are History is a Podmasters production.